This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Robert Wintner, also known as Snorkel Bob. Robert is executive director of the Snorkel Bob Foundation and active in Hawaii's conservation community, working diligently to protect Hawaii's reefs. He has worked against the aquarium trade in Hawaii and around the world. Robert has authored many novels, short story collections, and reef photo books, including two memoirs. Robert Wintner is here today to tell us about reef protection and his most recent book, Reef Libre, an in-depth look at Cuban exceptionalism and the last best reefs in the world, published in 2015. Welcome.
Aloha, Diane. It's great to be back. Thank you.
What led you to decide to check out the reefs in Cuba?
It was probably serendipitous. I stumbled onto a report that labeled these reefs as the last best reefs in the world. And specifically and technically, there are three standards used to judge them. It's the percentage of coral cover, biodiversity, which is the number of species. Many reefs around the world are missing numbers of species. And then the third one is apex predators. As you probably know, shark finning has been in the news the last couple of years, and very few people in the world realize that the key to ocean survival is apex predators, and in particular sharks. Keep in mind that all reefs in Cuba are less damaged than reefs anywhere else because Cuba has been in an industrial vacuum. There's been no development, not much of anything. The jewel in the crown in Cuba is about 70 miles south of the Cuban coast in the Gulf of Ana Maria. It's a place called Jardines de la Reina, the Gardens of the Queen. It's about 1,000 square miles. It's a mangrove estuary rising right up in open ocean, and it's the only place in the world that I know of that's rated 100% coral cover, 100% biodiversity, meaning optimal, meaning all species have returned there that were ever there, and a 100% complement of apex predators. That's barracuda, big morays, big groupers, and of course sharks. And seeing this, I just connected two dots. One is this element of, I hate to use the word, but it's as close to perfection as we have seen in our time. And the other is the age of both Fidel and Raul Castro. And they've made some startling decisions that affected the return of these places to natural perfection. And they're both very old. And my concern was, what happens if changes come to Cuba and these places are not protected? We will miss a once-in-a-lifetime chance to document conditions there, meaning photos and video of what's happening there underwater. And so we proceeded to set up the expedition, and it turned out to be quite timely with normalization of relations, maybe.
Before we focus in more on the reefs in Cuba, looking worldwide, what is the current state of the ocean reefs overall?
It's very poor. There are quite a few debilitating influences that I doubt will be changed in our lifetime. The obvious one, of course, is warming. Right up there with it is acidification, and a very close third is overfishing. The reefs are in very bad shape. Warming has caused huge debilitating die-offs, mostly in the Caribbean, but those dramatic losses are occurring as well in French Polynesia and in Asia. So it's going to be hard times, and personally, I just don't like to hear people say, let's save them for our children. Let's save them for the fish. And if our children benefit from that, then that's a plus. So I would say it's generally not good. Cuba has led the way. It may have been unwitting. It may have been serendipitous. It may have been random. But it happened, and we hope it doesn't go away.
Would you touch very briefly on how the aquarium trade has contributed to unhealthy reefs?
Well, it's devastating. That's a quote from one of the Hawaiian practitioners here in Hawaii. Devastating. There are vested interests both in state government and outside state government who say, well, it's not devastating, it's sustainable. They have no scientific evidence to show that. Any reef that's exposed to a challenge, whether it's warming or acidification, it's a very complex balance system. And the habitat and the species work hand in glove together to maintain that balance. It's just like, to use an analogy of a human body. A human body is millions of organisms working together. Something gets off kilter, you get sick. By taking species from reefs, you compromise those reefs. This is not complicated. For example, the aquarium trade in Hawaii takes millions of fish every year. 80% of them are yellow tangs. Yellow tangs are herbivores. They graze algae from dawn to dusk. And recent studies show that 80% of Hawaii reefs now suffer algae suffocation, algae overload. Algae grows naturally in the coral, and unless it's kept in check, it kills the coral. So, to use a platitude, this is a no-brainer. Another iconic example is the Hawaiian cleaner wrasse. It's endemic to Hawaii, found nowhere else in the world, and it picks parasites from the skin of other fish. To see a cleaner wrasse at work on a reef is a thing of beauty. It's a social event. The fish line up like cars at a car wash to wait their turn. They'll come into the cleaning area. It's a very specific spot. And they'll extend all their fins, flare their dorsal, and hold perfectly still while the cleaners come in. I've seen huge moray eels do this and then open their jaws wide. The cleaners will go inside to pick the goobers off the teeth, to pick parasites. And now the belief is that fish like to be touched. They like the grooming. It's a stress reliever. And in exchange for providing the grooming, the wrasse gets a meal. These wrasses are shipping out of Hawaii. I think they retail online for anywhere from $50 to $100. There's no protection for them. They're known to die in 30 days of captivity. It's insane, and it's cruel. So I do get emotional about this, but it's the sort of thing that it's so wrong, it's hard to stay calm and composed.
Now going back to the healthy Cuban reefs that you visited, you've started to allude to this, but would you paint a picture or describe what the reef looks like?
Well, it's beautiful. Every reef area around the world has its own character, its own nature. And just to inform the listeners briefly, on the west side of the USA, you have obviously the Pacific Ocean, and it tends to fall off very deep and quick. You can get very close to the shore, but offshore, and you're in deep ocean. On the east coast, it's all continental shelf. So you go out pretty good ways, and you'll still be in 40 or 50 feet of water. The Caribbean Sea is also known as the shallow sea. And anybody who's flown over it will recall the beautiful emerald colors. That's because you're looking at the bottom as it reflects light. So Caribbean reefs all are similar in nature. You get the fan corals, the whip corals. It's the coverage that we look at today as an indicator of reef health. And you do have some areas of rubble. It's substrate that won't sustain growth, but it's rare. In Cuba, every square foot of bottom is growing one form of coral or another. And the variety, it's just jaw-dropping. Huge basket sponges, tube sponges. Every particular species of coral, and I'm talking about when sponges look soft and if you touch one, it feels soft. Each one of these things is habitat for different species. So it's pretty wild in what you see. The Coral Triangle is a favorite dive spot, and that's in the Western Pacific and Indian Oceans. But the thing is, you can get into a place that has millions of fish and is still missing many species, and you won't know it. You can't realize what you're missing if you haven't seen it. And we know Cuba reefs are now supporting, the biodiversity has returned. And I think that one hopeful element of this is Jardines de la Reina was a fishing spot, one place they called Pepe's Fish Market. It was a fished-out bag of bones left for dead. It was lifeless. And that wasn't that long ago, maybe 20 or 25 years. It has bounced back, and today it is teeming. Another thing to keep in mind is because of geographic, just the situation of currents and so on, Jardines is not as susceptible to warming or acidification, which is a huge help. So as far as coral cover, it's dazzling. And within that coral cover are just millions of creatures, and it's a thing to behold.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Robert Wintner, author of the book Reef Libre, an in-depth look at Cuban exceptionalism and the last best reefs in the world. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you speak about the sharks that are found in the Cuban reefs?
Sure. Just to share a brief anecdote, we had heard that this would be a shark-based experience. But we pulled up to the mooring on our first dive at Jardines. We were staying on board a liveaboard vessel, and we went in a skiff to the dive site. And we got to the mooring, and our dive leader, very capable fellow Manuel, said, "This is a very special place. This is our intro dive or our checkout dive. Not too many sharks." And so we looked, and we saw a dorsal fin break the water. Now, we've seen plenty of sharks. It's not too often you see a dorsal fin break the water. But then we saw two more, six more, 12 more. We're a pretty macho crew, and we thought, why would we want to get out of a perfectly good boat in conditions like this? Well, Manuel read us in a blink. He said, "It's okay. Please, go to the bottom quick. Do not hesitate." And we did. You have a little trepidation. I'm not afraid to say it. These sharks were huge. Lengthwise, they were 10 to 12 feet, which is not extraordinary, but it's big. But the most impressive thing about them was their musculature and their girth. They were 4 to 5 feet thick. They were just huge, and they were everywhere. And so you do as you're told. We got in and dropped to the bottom, and it was a growth opportunity, and it was quick. And the sharks did not hurt us. By day two or three, we were familiar, we were comfortable, we were giddy with excitement with the contact. The sharks we encountered were reef sharks. They were Caribbean reef sharks, which are as docile as any reef sharks, and silky sharks, which can be more curious, and curiosity often leads to aggressiveness in sharks. The bull sharks, hammerhead sharks, and tiger sharks also live there. We did not see any, but they're known to be there. Getting so familiar with that many sharks, it gives you a confidence and a comfort level, which is should not be confused with arrogance. You still have to respect everybody. But I remember one day, about third or fourth day, we were in a little crevasse. The bottom was at 50 feet, and this crevasse went down another 15 or 20. And it was late in the day, and the sunlight was just beautiful. This was an underwater photographer's dream situation. And I stayed back to get some shots of an arrow crab or something intriguing. And everybody left. And that happens often if you're a reef photographer. You suddenly look up, and where did everybody go? But I could tell, easy to navigate because of the angle of the sunbeams. And I looked, and there was this huge shark, and I had nicknamed this shark Scarback because it liked me. It kept circling me. And circling is a typical shark behavior, generally prior to feeding. The circle gets smaller, and then there's the bump, and then you get tasted. But the shark coming straight at me was Scarback, and it suddenly dawned on me, and I thought to myself, "Oh, it's you." And I pulled my camera up and took a close-up of her face. You get that kind of conditioning where you don't react with fear. It's familiarity, recognition. And she saw me, and I saw her, and I took the picture, and she veered off and faded into the depth. That's what happened. Any healthy reef can and should support 15 to 20 sharks, and these all did. And there's another very minor element in the operation at Jardines, which is feeding the wildlife. And it dawned on me that these sharks were more curious than sharks usually were. And I asked Manuel, "Are you feeding the sharks?" And he gave a good answer, and I'm sure it's a question he got before. And he said, "We want to show our sharks in the best possible light. And if they don't show up, we can't do that. So we use a very minimum." And I felt like there's a big difference between breaking the rules and bending the rules. And in my humble opinion, the operation at Jardines was so good at stewarding those reefs and those critters that I, for one, forgave it. But it did leave those sharks curious. What do you got for me? But all in all, it was a wonderful experience. Those of us in tourism have to be very careful when endorsing or recommending a dynamic new destination because crowds of humanity can trample it in a heartbeat. But getting to Jardines is so demanding that only true reef people will go there. It's a 7-hour bus ride from Havana, followed by a 6 or 7 hour boat ride across the ocean, depending on conditions, to Jardines, where you stay for a week, and it's expensive. So I felt okay with a glowing review.
You alluded a bit to this earlier, but what factors have led to the health of Cuban reefs, to their not being degraded?
You know, if you set politics aside and you go specifically to the moment recovery began, it was when Fidel Castro one day, I'm not sure why, he is a scuba diver, and he was a fisherman, said, no mas, no more killing sharks. It's just that simple. And why he said that, to me, is a mystery. Maybe he knew something that nobody else knew. Scientists have predicted that if you put a ban on killing apex predators, they came up with a name for this, it's trophic cascading. And that means with more big eaters, they're going to eat more fish and populations will go down. Well, that's exactly wrong. If you think about this, you have a food chain. It's, as I said, it's complex and it's layered. If you remove the top layer, your apex predators, the next layer doubles because there's no check on population. The next two layers get cut in half because the layer above them has doubled. The next two layers double again. You see, so in the short term, you lose 50% of biodiversity. And I don't know what Fidel knew, but by bringing back the sharks, and also if you go to any reef in Asia where there used to be big groupers, and Hawaii, most people in Hawaii who've been here for years don't even know this. We used to have Goliath groupers here. And it's very hard to find one now because of the insatiable Asian appetite. I didn't make that phrase up. That was Tommy Remengasau Jr., who is president of Palau, who banned the aquarium trade. But if you're down on a reef and a 150-pound fish swims fast up to you, you know, you'll stop and you'll take a moment. And right behind him comes a 600-pound fish. You'll go like a statue. And it's a life-changing experience, and it's just the very best. And with the apex predators back in place, all the layers below that have been able to balance out, and the layers that were missing have returned. The ocean is resilient to a point. We're very near that point, and some places we're past that point, but that was the big difference, and that's where it started. I interviewed a very interesting, knowledgeable fellow who was a reef manager at Cayo Largo. I said, why did the sharks in Cuba, why were they threatened? You're nowhere near Asia. He said, we ate our sharks. Shark meat was our staple protein. And this is the big question that the book Reef Libre leaves you with. It's not a comfortable question. It's what's going to happen with a power change. The Cuban people are hungry. And I love the Cuban people. It's one of the very few cultures in the world, possibly the only one, besides ours and maybe Canada, that has a self-effacing sense of humor, incredible intellect and artistic expression. And they laugh at the idea of eating fried butter. You take a gob of butter, you roll it in flour, and you fry it, and you call it a meal. It's an extremely poor country. They're hungry. They want to eat fish, and they can't. They went from no more sharks to no more commercial fishing to no more recreational fishing. And as a reef advocate, I love it. As a Cuban resident, I probably would think otherwise. They want to eat fish. What's going to happen after the Castros? Well, we can only speculate. I hope the protections stay in place and that they can consider things other than seafood to eat. There's a whole bunch of steps between fried butter and seafood buffet that I wish that they could discover.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Robert Wintner, author of the book Reef Libre, an in-depth look at Cuban exceptionalism and the last best reefs in the world. Are there additional factors that have kept the Cuban reefs healthy?
In the book Reef Libre, one of the early photos is taken from the balcony of our room at the Copacabana Hotel in Havana. And it's, I don't know, it was on the 8th floor, so it was a pretty good distance that the shot carried. And it's empty. It's abandoned. Let's say this was, Miami. You'd be looking at billions and billions of dollars in commercial real estate. It looks like a ghost town. It's been untouched since 1959. Does that help with reef health in Havana? You bet. And so what are the other factors? In looking at their infrastructure, it is so decrepit. They have a word called derrumba in Spanish. It means implosion. Many of the buildings there implode, sometimes kills people. You have to assume that their sewage is direct drive, and that's going to have an effect. However, that was the very worst effect I could imagine. They have some very ugly oil rigs in Havana Harbor, but I think they're minimal. And with no industry development or so on, it just caused an incredible reef rebound. And I want to leave you with one little anecdote. My new friend, Fausto Denebi, I said, you know, Fausto, here's the problem. If this was Hawaii, you have these beautiful reef systems. If this was Hawaii and I was a developer, I would promise you that I could build 3,000 condos here and provide prosperity and jobs for everyone, and these reefs, they'd even be better. And Fausto chewed on that for about 4 seconds, and he said, that will not happen. What you fear will not happen here. And I said, and why not? He said, because we will fight. We know how to do that. And we had a fist bump, and I said, we're there together, brother. I hope it doesn't happen, but that's all we have to share is our hope. He said, okay. It just is a big question, and I don't know what the solution is. The only thing I've heard so far is to make Jardines de la Reina a World Heritage Site. It certainly qualifies.
What has been the view of the Cuban government toward the aquarium trade?
They don't allow it. And I asked Fausto about that, and he said, well, it's simple. That's commercial extraction, and so it's not allowed in principle. But they are so proud of the reefs, especially those where they have dive operations and take care of their reefs, that I think that they would frown on it. You have to weigh all assessments of Cuban decision-making with their extreme poverty. So I don't know what will happen. I just hope that they can connect the dots here and see that the aquarium trade is a bad deal.
Would you comment on the problems caused by release of lionfish from aquariums?
The biggest ocean catastrophe in our time is the lionfish invasion of the Atlantic and Caribbean Sea. There are now more lionfish there than all other species combined, and they have these lionfish rodeos which demonize the lionfish. It's a beautiful fish. It occurs naturally in the Indian and Pacific Ocean where the predators know how to eat them. In the Atlantic, and the lionfish have big spikes full of venom and they sting like crazy. The sharks go to eat them, get stung, and they won't try again. They have these lionfish rodeos that are just hateful, but the Cubans approached it more thoughtfully. They're catching the lionfish, and they kill them and despine them and hand-feed them to their sharks on certain reefs. The sharks not only get a taste for them, and then the sharks are willing to eat the lionfish and take the sting in order to get the meal, but the apex of the apex are teaching other sharks how to do this. And they have brought their lionfish into manageable control. It's been a lot of diligence and work, but diligence and work seems to be in good supply in Cuba. So they've led the way in a number of fields, and I support it, and I just hope it can continue.
What is your prediction for the future health of Cuban reefs?
That's a big question, Diane. They've been so hungry for revenue, they did not allow tourism, and then they began to tolerate it after the Soviet failure. They had no support from outside. They tolerated tourism. Then they saw the vast wealth available in tourism, and they embraced it. But we have an embargo, so we can't go there legally. But they get pretty good trade from Europe and Canada, and now we're going to normalize relations. Well, already, Raul is asking for return of Guantanamo, and the big one is he wants reparation. Well, where's the money? I just hope that he wants these things to do good work, like restoring the most incredible colonial architecture you have ever seen in your life in Havana Vieja. The buildings, you could just walk for block after block after block, and your jaw keeps dropping. It's so remarkably beautiful, and most of it is in ruins. And they've begun very slowly because they have no money to repair these things. That's where the money should go, inside, not outside. And what's going to happen? It just comes down to who's next and what the values are.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I would say visit a reef when you can. If you have an aquarium or you know somebody with an aquarium, please explain to them that these fish are not captive bred. 2% of the species of the aquarium trade are captive bred. 98% are wild caught. If you can visit a reef, do so. If you cannot visit a reef, buy a book like Reef Libre or get a video that shows you reef. They now have flat screen TVs with video loops showing non-repeated for 3 hours live footage of a reef. Aquariums are not happening. I'm particularly excited about this because we're introducing several bills in the Hawaii State Legislature to ban the aquarium trade in Hawaii as other places have done. Komodo National Park, we just got back from a couple months ago, banned the aquarium trade. The Free Republic of Palau banned the aquarium trade. Why Hawaii has not banned the aquarium trade? Well, money and power, The aquarium trade has done well to associate themselves with fishing. It is not fishing. The real fishermen here don't like these guys. They interfere with the food chain. They really undermine the game fish in their life cycle. And so overall, my message is, in one form or another, whether physically or vicariously, visit a reef and take a look and understand what's going on there. Underwater should not be under the radar. It's a really vibrant social system down there it's just there to accept and engage, and it goes both ways.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Robert.
Thank you, Diane. It's always good to talk to you.
You were just listening to Robert Whitner, also known as Snorkel Bob, author of Reef Libre, an in-depth look at Cuban exceptionalism and the last best reefs in the world, published in 2015 by Taylor Trade Publishing, an imprint of the Roman and Littlefield Publishing Group. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.